Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. I got 11 on one.
Okay, I'm just going to shoot him an email. I'm just seeing next talk.
So what I want to talk about today is to now begin to relate Fourier analysis to continuous time systems, and to in particular to talk about how to do a, we'll go through some circuit analysis problems, which I think are pretty interesting because you get to see how we look at circuits from a signals and systems point of view and how that relates to some of the specific techniques you learned about, things like Fourier analysis and phasors and impedances and all complex impedances and all those kinds of things. But like most of the time, to do that we have to do a little bit of math to set up some concepts, and then we can apply this to circuits. So let's talk about the response of a linear time invariant system to a sinusoid. If I apply a periodic signal to a linear time invariant system, what do I get out? Periodic signal. Maybe some amplitude change, maybe some phase change, but it's still periodic. So consider a linear time invariant continuous time system with impulse response h of t, and we can write that the output y of t is computed by taking h of t and convolving it with x of t. We write that as the integral of minus infinity plus infinity of h of lambda x of t minus lambda d lambda. We will assume that the Fourier transform of h of t exists, so we can write h of omega is equal to the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of h of t e to the minus j omega t dt. So we can compute the output using our Fourier transform properties. We can compute y of omega as h of omega times x of omega, and the magnitude of y of omega as the magnitude of h of omega times magnitude of x of omega, and the angle of y of omega is equal to the angle of h of omega plus the angle of x of omega. So that's sort of what we've talked about in the past few lectures when we've talked about Fourier transforms. And we can actually do that in the continuous time case or the discrete time case, though today we'll work mostly in the continuous time case. Now, suppose that a signal is x of t, suppose the input is a sinusoid. X of t is a cosine omega sub 0 t plus theta. So it's an amplitude, a frequency, and a phase. We have an amplitude, a frequency, and a phase. So if I apply this to a linear time invariant system, what do I get as output? You saw that problem on an exam. Here's a sine wave, here's a time invariant system, compute the output. The very first thing you should write is what? You should write y of t is equal to b cosine omega 0 t plus phi. And then you can say, I don't know how to compute b, I don't know how to compute phi, but give me some partial credit. And I have to give you partial credit because that's right. I mean, all that's going to happen is you're going to get a different amplitude and a different phase, but you're still going to get a cosine at that frequency for a linear time invariant system. If the system's nonlinear, you're going to get some other jump. And we talked about that when we talked about how an amplifier works, a real amplifier. So using the properties of the Fourier transform, we can write that x of omega is equal to a times pi times e to the minus j theta delta of omega plus omega 0 plus e to the j theta delta of omega minus omega 0. This is just taking the Fourier transform of this signal, and you've done that in your tables, or we could actually derive that if we work through the integrals. So if we multiply h of omega times x of omega, we can multiply this thing by h of omega, and that even though we don't know what h of omega is, we can actually show a very nice result. So when we multiply h of omega by this delta function, what happens? When you multiply a function by a delta function, what do you get as output? What property do we call that?
Or theorem?
The sifting property, right? Delta function is non-zero when? Delta of omega plus omega zero. When is this non-zero? It's non-zero for only one value of omega, which is
negative
of omega zero. So what's going to happen when you multiply h of omega by this?
You get it at the point. That makes it.
You just get h of minus omega zero. You just evaluate h at the only place where this is non-zero. So we get an h of minus omega zero, e to the minus j theta delta omega plus omega zero, and then for this term we get an h of omega zero. That's just using the sifting property. So we can pull out the magnitude of h of omega zero because the h of minus omega zero and h of omega zero have the same magnitude. And then we can also factor out the phase and write this as e to the minus j. Then we have the angle of h of omega zero times e to the minus j theta. And then here we have the angle of h of omega zero plus e to the j theta. Well, we can now combine these two and write the angle of h of omega zero plus theta and the angle of h of omega zero plus theta. And that allows us then to have this expression, which, if we now take the inverse Fourier transform, says that the amplitude just changes by this A times H of omega zero, times the magnitude of H of omega zero, and the phase changes by, we simply add the angle of H of omega zero. So this derivation says if we apply this signal to a linear time invariant system, y of t is equal to a times the magnitude of h of omega zero times the cosine of omega zero t plus theta plus the angle of h of omega zero. What does this act, what does this mean? Explain this to me in words.
Angle of h of omega zero.
Yeah, don't just say a times the magnitude.
The angle of h of omega zero is the phase shift?
Yes. And what is this? So you apply a cosine to this linear time invariant system. What comes out?
Cosine phase shifted and multiplied the amplitude.
The amplitude is changed by a factor related to what?
The impulse response.
Well, be more specific.
The amplitude.
You take the frequency response of the system and you evaluate it at omega zero. It's sampling the frequency response at one frequency, omega zero.
Yes.
So if you have the frequency response,
would that be considered the fundamental frequency, or is it just
convenient? You can say it's the fundamental frequency. It's, you know, if you have some kind of frequency response, it's just essentially evaluating it at omega zero. This amplitude is how you compute the amplitude of the output. And then similarly, you sample the phase function, whatever the phase looks like. You sample the phase function at omega zero, and that phase shift is what gets added to the input. So the output of a linear time invariant system just has an amplitude which is scaled by the frequency response of the system and a phase which is increased by the phase of the system. Very simple, very easy to compute. And it gives you some idea of how the frequency response of the system impacts the output. So let's now try to relate this to RC circuit. So here we have a series RC circuit. We have an input, x of t. We're going to define as the output the voltage y of t as the voltage across this capacitor. And we have this differential equation, which we derived earlier in the semester, that describes this this circuit. We have dy dt plus 1 over RC times Y of T is equal to 1 over RC times X of T. Now, this is a differential equation, we can take the Fourier transform of this equation, and we can write j omega times y of omega plus 1 over rc times y of omega is equal to 1 over rc times x of omega. This is where your circuit analysis comes from, where you do things like you write the impedance of this as 1 over j omega c. So we can then solve for y of omega as a function of x of omega using simple algebra. And we can write that the transfer function h of omega is 1 over rc divided by j omega plus 1 over rc. We can write that the magnitude of h of omega is 1 over rc divided by the square root of omega squared plus 1 over rc squared. And the angle is just minus the inverse tangent of omega rc. Then we can throw this into MATLAB now and you can compute the frequency response. So here we have the MATLAB code for computing the magnitude and the angle and the phase response of that system. And we see that in fact this is a low pass filter. It's got this low pass filter characteristic associated with it. And you can talk about 3 dB points and things like that in terms of the value of RC. So this is something that you've done before, but now you see its relationship to the Fourier transform. But now we can go a little bit further and we can actually compute the output of this system to some different types of signals. So for example, we can compute the output for a value of RC, which is 0.001, and an input signal that has an input cosine that has a frequency of 1,000 radians per second. We can write that y of t is equal to the magnitude of h of omega evaluated at at omega zero, and that turns out to be 0.707 in this case, times cosine of 1,000 t plus theta minus 45 degrees. Again, just evaluating the angle of h of omega at 1,000 radians. We can similarly compute the output for omega 0 equals 3,000 radians per second and write this equation. Now, what do you notice about the difference in amplitude between these two signals? One is at a frequency of 1,000 radians per second, one is at a frequency of 3,000 radians per second.
It's attenuated at 3,000
radians. Right, the amplitude at 3,000 is lower than the amplitude at 1,000. So this is in fact acting like a low pass filter, which we saw on the previous page when we looked at the frequency response. So if the input was the sum of two sine waves, we could actually compute the output as the sum of two sine waves doing the same kind of thing. So here we have an example of the input x of t, which is cosine 100t plus cosine 3000t. So you have sort of a carrier frequency, which is one at a frequency of 100 radians per second. And then on top of that, you have this higher frequency of 3,000 radians per second. And when we apply this signal to the circuit, what happens is the carrier frequency, the high frequency component is attenuated more relative to the carrier frequency. So you have a nice graphical display here of what it means to have a low pass filter. What you've done is essentially attenuate the high pass filter pair, high pass, or the higher frequency components of this signal, so you've reduced the variation around the carrier frequency. So a visual demonstration of what it means to have a low pass filter. Now that we've computed, we've learned how to compute the output for one sine wave, we can very easily extend that to all periodic signals using what? Using what technique or what transform that we have access to?
Transform.
the exponential true?
The what?
Exponent. Never mind.
So how do we represent arbitrary periodic signals? What representation technique have we talked about?
Fourier series.
Fourier series, right? And how do we represent a signal as a Fourier series? We use either a sum of exponentials or a sum of sines and cosines. Same difference. So we can extend our example to all periodic signals using the Fourier series because with the trigonometric form of the Fourier series, and this is actually what we call the phase form, we can write x of t as a constant plus the sum of these a sub k's times cosine k omega 0 t plus theta sub k. So we write the signal as a cosine with an amplitude and a phase. And this is a variant of the trigonometric Fourier series. So now we can apply this to a linear time invariant system. Well, since it's a linear system, the system operating on the sum of sine waves is equal to the sum of the outputs of the individual sine waves. So we can just repeatedly apply our principle that the output is going to be this constant times the transfer function evaluated at zero plus the sum from k is equal to 1 to infinity. We have a sub k times the magnitude of the transfer function evaluated at k omega 0 times the cosine of k omega 0 t plus theta sub k, that just comes from here, plus the angle of the transfer function evaluated at a frequency of k omega 0. So this is simply writing the output as we have a constant, a DC term that gets scaled. We have the amplitude of the cosines that get scaled by the transfer function. And we have an additional phase shift, which is also related to the phase shift, to the phase of the transfer function evaluated at each of the harmonics. And we can also write this in terms of the complex Fourier series using our relationships between the C's and those coefficients. So it's important to observe that since the spectrum of a periodic signal is a line spectrum, the output spectrum is simply a weighted version of the input, where the weights are found by sampling the frequency response at multiples of the fundamental frequency. So if you have a frequency response of a linear time invariant system and you apply a periodic signal to that system, the amplitudes that you're going to get are just going to come from sampling that frequency response at multiples of the fundamental frequency. So that gives you a nice sort of intuitive explanation for what happens when you apply a periodic signal to a linear time invariant system. So let's apply this concept. Let's look at what happens when we apply a rectangular pulse train to our RC circuit. So here we have a rectangular pulse train, and now we're going to apply this to our RC circuit. So now, what do you expect you're going to see for the output of the circuit? So what's that going to look like? We should have with this pulse some kind of charge and discharge, right?
Right. Yeah.
Something like that, right? So these are rounded versions of this. Why do you think these shapes are smoother than these shapes?
It takes time for the capacitor to charge.
Yeah, well, that's electrical engineering. Give me a mathematical explanation.
Oh, okay.
That's a physics. That's too much physics for you this morning. Give me a signal processing explanation.
It's going to act as a low-pass filter.
Low-pass filter, right? This is a low-pass filter. These pulse, these transitions have a lot of high-frequency content. That gets attenuated by the low-pass filter. So the output is rounded. So we can take, we have actually worked in the past, the Fourier series of this pulse train can be written as A0 plus the sum from k is equal to 1 to infinity of a sub k cosine pi k pi times t, where A0 is equal to 0.5 and a sub k is this sine x over x type function.
Are we taking the output as the voltage across the resistor?
Voltage across the capacitor.
Okay.
That was... taking voltage here. So when you set the problem up this way, then you get this differential equation. So the transfer function that we computed, which is essentially a constant over j omega plus that constant, is with respect to the voltage across the capacitor being the output, and the voltage across this, the input, the voltage across.
Okay.
So we know that the system response is 1 over RC plus J omega, 1 over RC divided by the quantity J omega plus 1 over RC. So now we can apply our equation for the output, and we can write that the DC term is simply going to be the DC term of the input times H evaluated at 0, which in this case A0 was 0.5, and this thing evaluated at 0 just gives us gives us 1. So we have 0.5 times 1, which is 1, which is 0.5. And then we have the scale factor on the cosine term is going to be a sub k, the sine pi, k pi over 2 divided by k pi over 2, times the magnitude function evaluated at k omega 0. So we can write this times this thing evaluated at frequencies of k times pi. That's the frequency of that sine wave. So we can write that the output, the amplitudes on these cosines for the output has this form of 2 over k pi times this 1 over RC divided by the square root of k pi squared plus 1 over RC squared for k is equal to odd, and then for k is equal to even, that these coefficients are 0. So if we plot this as a function of frequency, we get the plot that looks something like this. It has that sine x over x shape, but every other harmonic is 0. And that, if you were to take the inverse Fourier transform of this, you will get something that looks like that. And I think I think the slide on the next page shows that. Yeah. So we can then take those amplitudes and we can write an equation which represents the Fourier series of the output as just this A0 superscript y, which is the output DC term, plus the sum of these amplitudes times cosine k pi t minus the phase shift, which is the inverse tangent of k pi rc. So we have the amplitude of the linear time invariant system and the phase of the linear time invariant system. So we can observe the implications of low-pass filtering this signal. We can now plot this output as a function of different time constants. So here we have 1 over RC is equal to 1. Here we have 1 over RC is equal to 10, and here we have 1 over RC is equal to 100. And these are the corresponding output signals that we achieve, and they're represented by this Fourier series. So as we noted that these sharp transitions in the input create high frequency information. So when we increase 1 over RC, what are we actually doing if we hold the resistance constant, for example? So let's say the resistance is 1 ohm. Increasing 1 over RC is the equivalent of doing what to the capacitance?
Decreasing
the capacitance. And what? Now we can talk physics. What does that do in terms of the behavior of the circuit?
Lowers the time constant.
It allows it to charge faster. And that's what we're essentially seeing on the output here. As I lower the time constant, the circuit's able to charge faster. Now, why do we see these oscillations? Where did we see that before? That's the Gibbs phenomenon. So, what we've shown here is that for any periodic signal, if I give you any periodic signal and I give you a linear time invariant system, you can compute the output. And what are the steps in that computation?
The cosine.
So I give you a periodic signal. So step one. And I give you a linear time invariant system. So you can confuse the output. What's first step?
Fourier transform
of what?
The input and the response.
Right, so we have to compute a Fourier series of x of t. We have to compute a Fourier transform of h of t. Then what? What?
Then the magic happens.
No. Then we do what? No magic. We have one of these wonderful equations that So once you have these two things, you apply this equation. You need to have samples of the frequency response of the system at frequencies multiples of the input frequency. And then once you have that,
multiply.
So we apply our magic equation.
Yay.
Not so magic, though. And then you can plot the output, or you can listen to it, or whatever you want. But the steps are essentially straightforward. Fourier series of the input, Fourier transform of the system, multiplication of the coefficients, and you've got it. And that works for any periodic signal, any linear time invariant system. So you can write a piece of MATLAB code to do this, and then you have a general solution.
So in erasing your H of T looks like the stock market.
Okay, so what do we do for non-periodic signals? And don't make me hit the board again.
I was just going to ask.
Instead of using the Fourier series, you just use the Fourier transform.
Fourier transform. So, we take the Fourier transform of the input, we take the Fourier transform of the system, we multiply the two together, and we get the Fourier transform of the output. So, here we have an example of doing that for a single pulse. We can take the Fourier transform of the pulse, Fourier transform of the RC circuit, we multiply them together, and we get the Fourier transform of the output, and then we can somehow go back to compute the inverse Fourier transform to get back to the original signal. Well, fortunately, this is fairly easy to do in MATLAB. So here we have some MATLAB code where we multiply the two transforms together, and then we get the magnitude plot of the output. And I think on the next page you actually have some of that. Yeah. So then we can recover the output using the inverse Fourier transform. So here we have, we'll use the symbolic toolbox for that. We're going to have our transform of the input, our transform of the output, we multiply them together, and then we take the inverse Fourier transform, and then we can plot y of t. So here we have the frequency responses for 1 over RC is equal to 1, 1 over RC is equal to 10, and here we have the corresponding outputs y of t. And you'll notice that they look very similar to what we got for the periodic case. We have the charge and the discharge. It's just we only have one of these instead of the periodic signal. And since the pulses were spaced far enough apart, there's no overlap between the pulses. So that all looks pretty clean. Be careful when you're trying to do these inverse Fourier transforms on complicated transforms. MATLAB works very nicely on some of the small cases, but when you get to some of the larger cases, you have to, sometimes it doesn't give you a result, and you have to be a little more careful about that. That actually happened on a final exam last semester, which is kind of interesting. I gave them a bigger circuit, and some of the ways they tried to compute it, MATLAB broke. It couldn't produce the result, so they kind of panicked. But there were other ways to work the problem that we were getting right. So, we've now talked about the response of linear systems to both periodic and aperiodic inputs. So now we can formalize the concept of a filter. Most systems can be thought about in terms of it as being a filter. So the process of rejecting particular frequencies or a range of frequencies is called filtering. A system that has this characteristic is called a filter. An ideal filter is a filter whose frequency response goes exactly to zero for some frequencies and whose magnitude response is exactly one for other ranges of frequencies. So this is an example of an ideal low-pass filter. Now why, aside from this definition, why would you consider this an ideal filter? Suppose you were taking your favorite piece of music and processing it through this filter. Why is it important to you that this be absolutely flat?
You don't want to alter the original content.
The original content over that frequency range. So whatever comes into the system in this frequency range will come out of the system. So the fact that this is flat is important because that means the system is not introducing any distortion. Now in practice, when you build filters, when we get to that part later in the course, you'll find out we can't really build something like this. There's always a little bit of ripple in the passband, and that ripple is distortion. And when you're trying to build filters that have really high performance, like filters for very high quality stereo equipment, that kind of ripple becomes a real problem because it's distorting the signal. And we used to talk about if you want to build electric circuits that operate at signal-to-noise ratios of about 60 to 80 dB, that's actually fairly easy to do. If you want to build circuits that operate at 100 dB signal-to-noise ratio, very high performance, very low noise, that's much harder to do because now you start to worry about some of the physics that Dr. Winton talks about, some of the really fine details of the physics, because to build a circuit that has 100 dB signal-to-noise ratio is very difficult in practice. Just electromagnetic radiation from the surrounding environment and that in itself can cause problems. So to build filters that are perfectly flat is very, very difficult in practice. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, why that is. But this is what we call the ideal low-pass filter. It's flat in the pass band, identically zero in the stop bands. This is what we call the ideal bandpass filter. This is what we call the ideal high-pass filter, and this is what we call the ideal band stop filter. Now, thinking about this concept we call duality, what is the concept of duality?
Two.
What?
Two.
Two what? Dual, two?
Two things are alike.
So how do we define duality in the context of the Fourier transform?
Oh.
Time domain, frequency domain representation.
Could you be more specific? There's two kind of concepts I would like you to think about to associate with duality. One is that you have a signal, you take the Fourier transform of that signal, you get something. If you now take that something and take the Fourier, treat it as a signal, and take the Fourier transform of that, what do you get? You get something very close to the original signal. There's a scale factor involved. So that's one example. That's sort of one manifestation of duality. The other thing that we talked about, which is more relevant to this problem, is that if a signal has a narrow extent in the time domain, like a pulse, what is its extent in the frequency domain?
Wide.
Wide. And if the signal is wide in the time domain, it's narrow in the frequency domain. So why can you not go to Radio Shack and get one of these? Actually, there's all sorts of cool stuff now. It's really
well.
As I was explaining before the beginning of class, I'm not supposed to politicize in class. I read a book on my last trip about this, so I will not comment on that. But if you go to Radio Shack and ask the salesperson for ideal low pass filter, just go to the back and get one of those ideal low pass filters. They're going to have a bit of a problem. Why? I think I told you, Joe, we used to do that in our, every now and then, try to get one of our new graduate students to go to Radio Shack and ask for something really silly. It was sort of one of those rites of passage for joining our research group. We had a lot of fun with it over the years.
Did you get Tal?
Now, we didn't put Tal through our standard initiation process. We were reading out.
Never too late.
Never too late. So, what is the impulse response associated with this frequency response going to look like?
Wide.
It's going to be very wide in the time domain, right? And is it going to have a positive going portion or a positive and a negative going portion? The function, we actually derived the inverse transform of this. It's a sinc function. And it extends infinitely both in positive time and negative time. That means it's a non-causal filter, which means we cannot implement this out of components like resistors and capacitors. Now, another thing about the ideal low-pass filter, we also want it to have a linear phase response over the bandwidth of interest Y. We said phase response is equivalent to what in the time domain? Phase delay in the frequency domain is equivalent to
time
delay in the time domain. Now, why do you want the phase response to be linear? So you're sitting there with your popcorn and your drink, you're ready to watch Star Wars or whatever it is, you guys, Matrix or whatever you guys watch these days. What was that one that just Eclipse or what was that? And you're sitting in the middle of your room because you've got your speakers set up and everything, only the stereo you bought wasn't designed by one of our graduates, so they didn't get this phase response linear. What's going to happen in that wonderful surround sound experience you're about to try to enjoy? The time delays are going to get screwed up. So the sounds are not going to converge at the right point in space, and your surround sound is going to be not sound very good.
So that cause your high frequency to get to you longer than your short?
Well, it depends on the phase response, but yeah, that's basically what happens. So the sound, you know, the surround sound principle is designed so that you can, things will converge in space and time and all that, and you'll get the perception of sound occurring in a particular space.
So if you had two filters and one enclosure with two speakers and the phase response was off, they could actually be mismatched in time.
Yes. So we want linear phase response because that means all of we're going to have a uniform time delay, and we won't alter the structure of that signal in applications like surround sound. Because this means that the time delay will simply be a function of frequency. It will not be distorted. If it has a non-linear phase response, different frequencies are going to be delayed different amounts, and the signal is going to get up. It will lose its coherence, is another way to describe that. And actually, similar properties like this are hold for optics. I don't know if they still do optics labs in your physics classes, but you can demonstrate the same kind of principles with lasers and optics. You can make lasers converge to a particular. I don't know if you've ever seen someone line lasers up and shoot them down a hallway and make them converge at a point down the hallway and all that. You can do the same kind of thing with this kind of concept of phase. You know, you never saw somebody take a laser and make it converge at very vaporized points in space down the hallway.
No.
They don't get to do all those cool things anymore.
Somebody might get hurt.
So, using the Fourier transform here for rectangular pulse and applying time shift property, we can write that this is the impulse response of the ideal low-pass filter with a flat frequency response and a linear phase response. And as we said, this is a non-causal filter. Its impulse response looks like this, and because it has a non-zero portion for t less than zero, this is a non-causal filter, and it cannot be implemented, therefore, using simple RC circuits. We can define the frequency response of an ideal bandpass filter in a similar way. We can have the frequency response be flat, the magnitude, and a linear phase over a portion of the frequency range. This is what's called an ideal bandpass filter. But it's still physically unrealizable because of these sharp transitions essentially give you this infinite impulse response of the sync function. So the process of approximating these things then, this is a good news story, because in the 60s and 70s, this is what electrical engineers essentially worried about, how to build filters that are really, really sharp, but have a minimal number of components associated with them. And that's the whole process of what we call filter design. And out of that came some very nice theory about Butterworth, Chebyshev, elliptical, all these kinds of filters. And we'll talk about those a little later in the semester. But in the 60s, if you were an electrical engineer, you would take courses in filter design, but then you'd also take courses in what was called passive and active network synthesis. which was the process of going from a frequency, arbitrary frequency response to a passive circuit or an active circuit. So building things out of RLCs is a passive problem, building things out of op amps and such is the active problem. And you could make good money, so to speak, being an engineer who was really good at that stuff. Well, by the 90s and the year 2000, those jobs don't exist anymore. Why?
DSP.
Because, well, partly DSP, but even prior to DSP.
Software.
You can basically do all this automatically in software now. So the solutions to those problems became well known and well understood and programmed into computers, so essentially you don't need high-priced engineers to do those jobs anymore. And generally that's what you'll find with a lot of circuit analysis these days is once you have an idea of what you actually want to achieve in terms of the frequency response and the impulse response and things like that, there are automated design tools that will actually produce the circuits that achieve those characteristics within reason. And the within reason part is that the tools work great when you're working on at fairly low frequencies or fairly mundane stuff. But of course, when you're trying to build Intel's latest and greatest microprocessor and you're pushing the limits of the technology, you're running at such high speeds that you're literally pushing the limits of the semiconductors, then you actually have to understand a lot of this because every little trace in the circuit becomes an issue, time delays associated with the different traces, crosstalk between the traces, all that kind of stuff. So the design tools are great until you sort of get to the very edge of where they operate. And therefore, as you go faster and faster with circuits, which is pretty much true of almost any circuit these days, you're always trying to push the limits of your technology, then the modeling tools only give you approximate solutions, and you have to do a little bit of additional sort of manual tweaking to get them right.
I forgot who told me this, but somebody said that the faster the digital system gets, the more it approaches the behavior of an analog system.
Yeah, I don't know. Does anyone here have worked for DTI? I used to kind of work with DTI a little bit. And, a friend of mine, former student here, used to design their circuit boards, and I remember him showing me one of their latest circuit boards about 5 years ago. And you know, you have all these parallel traces, and every one of them was essentially a transmission line that had to be hand-tuned because the circuit was running at the very limit of what the board was able to handle. So they do a lot of electromagnetic analysis and optimization to actually get the signals to arrive at the right points at the right time. Another example, one of my personal story about that was when I was at Texas Instruments when they produced the first Sun Spark chip. And that chip was pushing the limits of the BiCMOS process that they were using to manufacture it. And when they started, it's a very nice case study. I won't tell you the whole story, but the gist of it was they signed a contract with Sun and HP to deliver this chip by a certain date. And when the first chips rolled off the production line in Japan, I was actually in Japan at the time, the yield was like 0.1%. They just were not getting anything out of the production line. So one day, a stream of limousines arrived in the rice fields in Japan where this plant were. All the CEOs from all these companies, it was like the mafia getting together. I mean, every famous person in the industry was there. And the president of TI had to get up and say how they were going to fix this problem and meet the contract that they signed. Well, they ended up doing enormous amounts of, they couldn't change the technology itself, but they changed the manufacturing process to improve the yield. But they actually did things like change the implementation of the instruction set to allow the chip to sort of survive all the electromagnetic effects of the paths within the chip and things. So they did both software and hardware and manufacturing process designs. And to my amazement, in about 6 months, they had the yield up to about 25%, which was the threshold at which they could start making money. But the company spent a ton of money on this problem and brought all the senior engineers together. It was really cool to see all this happen because the stakes were so high. But it was very much a case where they were working at the limits of the semiconductor process, so they had to hand-tune quite a lot of things. And they even got into issues like the purity of the chemicals that they were using, and so everything that came into the factory was tested for its purity and all that kind of stuff. And every little thing made a difference. So yeah, you do get, the tools are good for sort of the well-known kind of average performance, but with a lot of circuits, you're operating at the edge, and that's where your insight into these kinds of concepts will become really important. Okay, so I'll see you on Friday.